we've never done that to the Antarctic ice sheet base. But that information is fundamental to models of ice sheet flow and therefore for prediction of global sea level. So it is something that is missing. We have a rudimentary understanding of what's underneath the ice, but not in an optimized way, optimized for the use of modeling. And so we urgently need that. And me and quite a few other people are starting to contemplate how we go about providing that survey and offering it to everybody, because it's urgently needed for future generations to understand how sea level is going to go up. But when I was speaking to decision makers and politicians, well, I stopped talking about global heating, because it feels, when you do that, that global warming and global heating is the cause. It isn't. The cause is burning fossil fuels. And we absolutely must transition to net zero as quickly as we possibly can by mid-century in the next 30 years. And then that gives us a chance. It gives us a chance to restricting global warming to 1.5 degrees, so that's another 0.3 degrees above where we are at the moment, and to maintaining the sanctity, the preservation of the Antarctic continent and the Greenland ice sheets, of course, in some way. Because if we don't do those things, then those ice sheets are lost, and for many generations after us, they'll feel the consequences.
From the Grantham Institute for Climate Change and Imperial College London, we've been speaking with Professor Martin Siegert. You can find links to the new paper, Antarctic Extreme Events. It's free access. It's in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Martin Siegert, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The Guardian headline reads, "Fears over Antarctic sea ice as yearly ozone hole forms very early." And what is all this talk about solar storms and climate change? Only a unique scientist could explain all that, and we have reached him. Dr. Martin Eucher trained in plasma physics in Switzerland, but now he lectures at the Climate Change Research Centre, University of New South Wales in Australia. Martin also serves as associate investigator at the ARC Centre for Excellence for Climate Extremes in Australia. He can be our doorway into these frontiers of science. From Sydney, Australia, Martin Eucher, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, just as an introduction, your original field, what is plasma physics?
Oh, that was all about generating energy with nuclear fusion rather than fission. To do that, you need a so-called plasma, which is a fourth state of matter, which is after gas. You heat even more. You start separate electrons and ions from the atoms, and that creates a plasma. So it's got nothing to do with the medical plasma, which you might have in mind when you hear the word plasma.
Right. Why are you now publishing climate-related research?
Oh, I've been working in climate for 12 years now. And that was just after my thesis, PhD thesis in plasma physics. I was just ready for another subject. I wanted to explore something else. And it turns out that in physical terms, atmospheric dynamics is, in a way, an application of fluid dynamics, and so is plasma physics. So the two fields aren't that different.
So let's get to that Guardian headline. What is the news about the ozone hole this year, Martin?
Yeah, so the ozone hole formed rather early. It's not the earliest in history, but it was quite early in particular because we're all hoping that this ozone hole is closing slowly. And so, it opened up early, and it developed into quite, much bigger than it normally was in August. And since then, it came back a little for a few days, and then it's gone up again, and currently it's not the largest we've ever seen, but it is the largest from, the last few years, certainly. So it's just pretty large, and we expect it to grow more because it usually peaks around October, maybe November. So it's going to grow more.
So this dangerous state of affairs in the upper atmosphere has not gone away. How could changes in the ozone hole affect sea ice formation around Antarctica?
Yeah, so Well, what the ozone itself, when it's there in the stratosphere, does, it does, is that it blocks solar radiation. And in particular, why it's been so much concern for us humans is that it blocks ultraviolet radiation, which is very energetic and which is, of course, a health concern for us if that radiation reaches the surface. So normally that ozone is there and removes all of that radiation because in the chemical cycle of ozone, its life cycle, if you like, it consumes this radiation, it absorbs it. And when that ozone is not there, it reaches the surface. And so the link to sea ice, it is not a very clear link there, but what's happening is that all of this energy that now does hit the surface, and in particular the ozone hole is strongest over the pole and close to Antarctica. So all of that energy would hit not the ice, but the ocean water around the sea ice, or in which the sea ice, the icebergs are floating. And thus it could heat up the water, which then would melt more ice.
And this ozone hole is developing now, which in the southern hemisphere would be almost the beginning of spring, so that it's going to be fairly large when the sun is there, really there, almost 24 hours a day at some point.
Yes, no, that's correct. So by December, it will probably still be there, although then through more of the summer, our summer, as in January, February, the ozone hole disappears because there's different mechanisms. There's ozone being transported from elsewhere over where the ozone hole used to be. And one thing about the ozone hole is that in order to develop, it needs very low temperatures. And in summer, even up in the stratosphere, it's actually too warm. And so the hole closes again. And then it can open again the year after. But really the concern is this month of, well, end of November and December, when, of course, December is the solstice. So, yes, that's when the sun is strongest.
Now, you talk and work with other scientists, including Matthew England. What are people thinking is driving this sudden decline of Antarctic sea ice?
So there's a lot of people working on this. There are also, here in Australia, there's centers where many, many different scientists come together and work specifically on Antarctic science. So it's a big focus where a lot of people work on why currently the sea ice is so low. I guess the main reason is that the sea temperatures, so the oceans are so warm. And I'm sure everybody's seen those plots as well, with this year just being way off what any other year was. And of course, warm water melts the ice. You know that from your cocktail, right? You put ice in and you don't drink it immediately. The ice goes away, it melts. The main concern is really the warm waters, and why this year they are so high is actually a good question. I don't think anybody really knows why this year is so much warmer than the previous year, for example.
That is what I'm hearing from other scientists. Many are surprised and puzzled, and I'm sure there's a lot of analysis going on trying to find that out. Now, I want to talk for a little minute about the stratosphere and the troposphere. These are the two sort of layers that we designate in the atmosphere. And generally, there's a careful distinction between the two. And we've been told, well, weather happens in the troposphere, which is nearest to the surface here, but not really in the stratosphere. They operate on almost different rules. But are scientists discovering interaction, more interaction than we thought, between these two layers of the atmosphere?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's all correct. So the big difference is really the what the temperature does as you go up into higher altitude. We all know that if you go up, if we hike up a mountain, or if you look at the temperature display in an airplane, the higher we go, the colder it gets. That's in the troposphere. But the distinction is made in the stratosphere is that the higher it gets, it actually gets warmer again. And that is exactly due to the ozone, which absorbs radiation and therefore warms up. And there's more ozone as you go higher up. And so that makes a big difference, because it means that in the troposphere, where it gets colder, you may know that warmer object or a warmer fluid, a warmer air or warmer water, is lighter than colder air or water. And so when it's warmer, it floats up. It's like a bubble in your lemonade. It floats up, and it's warmer than the surroundings, so it floats up even more because as hot, when it gets higher, all its surroundings is getting cooler and cooler. And so that creates thunderstorms, for instance, and that creates what we call the weather in the troposphere. But in the stratosphere, if something rises, it's going to be cooler than its surroundings all the time because as it rises, the surrounding is warmer, and so it will sink back down because it's heavier than all its surroundings. So that's the big difference with the stratosphere. There is no thunderstorms, none of those thick clouds, no rain in the stratosphere because of that. And now, yes, you've mentioned, we discover more and more that these two layers, they used to be thought of as distinct because the processes that are happening are so different. But we now find that there's a lot of interaction between how the winds, how strong the winds are in the stratosphere, and that has implications how our surface weather behaves.
In 2021, you co-authored a paper about sudden stratospheric warming events in Antarctica. What are they, and can they affect ice melt or sea ice formation or anything lower down?
Yes, so sudden stratospheric warmings are exactly when the winds in the stratosphere, usually in the winter in the stratosphere, there are very strong winds, and we call this the polar vortex. That's up in the stratosphere. And when these winds, for various reasons, they can suddenly become much weaker, or they can even reverse direction. And that's a sudden, we call this a sudden warming because this is always also accompanied with the temperature getting warmer. The winds get weaker, the temperatures get warmer. But that's only in the stratosphere. But it turns out that these events have strong impacts at the surface. And that's in both hemispheres. When the winds in the stratosphere in the winter get weaker, usually that means that the jet stream in the troposphere, so the strong winds which we also have in the troposphere, they shift towards the equator. And that would mean more cold snap, for instance, for continental America, or so the U.S., Canada, North America, that would mean we have a higher risk of cold snaps because the polar air can now come further southward than usual. And so in the southern hemisphere, the same thing happens. It's just that there's not so many continents and not so many people living where the most of the effect is, but we have the same shift, we have the same expansion of polar air towards the equator, and that has implications on sea ice as well, because it means that the winds are different, so the sea ice, the floating sea ice is being blown into different directions, but it's also generally colder, so there will be less melting or even an expansion of sea ice when these events happen.
And yet that 2021 paper concludes there will be far fewer appearances of sudden stratospheric warming in Antarctica as the planet warms. They may be hundreds of years apart instead of 1 in 22 years, just as an example. So sudden stratospheric warming may not matter much anymore, at least at the South Pole.
Yes. So one caveat to that result is that what we used in that study is the same definition for Antarctica as we normally use for the North Pole, so for the Arctic. But there exist events, so these warmings, which are, and those are based on very strong events, because they happen often enough in the Northern Hemisphere that we can concentrate only on the strongest of these events. But in the Southern Hemisphere, so what our paper showed was similarly strong events are basically a thing of the past. They're not going to happen anymore. But what different research from different groups around the world has shown is that in the Southern Hemisphere, we don't need such strong events to still have a surface impact. So we are now actually currently working on looking at how could we redefine these sudden warmings to detect events which still have an impact, but might actually, which we should expect to still happen in the future.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is scientist Dr. Martin Eucher from the University of New South Wales, Australia. Well, during the 2011 Fukushima nuclear power disaster, a camera caught Reactor 3 explode, and it blasted radioactive materials into the stratosphere, and that turned out to be very important. We learned radioactivity would stay up a longer time and fall back all over the Northern Hemisphere. So the key to a local event going global is reaching the stratosphere. And why is that, and how does that apply to that Tongan volcano eruption in January of 2022?
Yes, so what's important here is what I described as the difference between the stratosphere and the troposphere is that there's no weather, no storms, no rain in the stratosphere. So anything that goes gets blown into the troposphere, so the air close to the surface but stays there, will rather quickly be part of a storm, be in a cloud, and then be actually rained out, and it will, in such a way, it will be removed rather quickly from the air because it will just fall down together with raindrops, or the strong winds will blow it somewhere else, and then it finally will end up in some rain event. But when it reaches the stratosphere, there is no rain, there is no thunderstorms, and so those particles, they're pretty light, so they're getting just... They can float for a long time, and if the winds are strong enough, which is the case in the stratosphere, they are getting distributed all over the globe, just as you mentioned before. And then they will slowly, again, because they're so light, they will eventually fall down due to gravity, but that will take a long time because they're so light and small, and there's no raindrops which would drag them down. And the same thing happened with the Hunga Tonga eruption in January 2022, when a lot of not radioactive material this time, but water vapor was injected into the stratosphere. That water came from the ocean water above the volcano, because the volcano erupted underwater. That was just evaporating all the water. It was just steam, an enormous cloud of hot steam, which reached the stratosphere. And that water is still in the stratosphere, and we expect it to impact surface climate for 7 to 8 years.
Well, it's so weird because we expect volcanic eruptions to cool the planet a little, but now this eruption is considered a warming influence by some.
So this volcano is very special because in a normal volcano you would have lots of smoke as well, and you would have sulfur in particular. You would smell of rotten eggs. And that smoke and sulfur, that actually acts to reflect solar radiation when it's in the atmosphere. And so you would have a cooling effect. But now this volcano had almost no sulfur or no smoke because it was an underwater volcano. And in turn, it had a lot of water vapor, and now water vapor is the strongest greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. And this is why we could expect or might expect a warming at the surface due to this volcano rather than a cooling, simply because what's been blown into the stratosphere is a greenhouse gas.
Well, let's peek into another of your new co-authored papers. And here we learn that there are, in fact, maybe they're light, but there are some clouds in the stratosphere. Published March 13, 2023, the title is Can Polar Stratospheric Clouds Explain Arctic Amplification? And I tuned right in when you suggested connections between increasing methane in the atmosphere, and it certainly is increasing, to very high polar clouds. And then that somehow feeds back to extra warming in the Arctic. Could you please draw us that map of how that works?
Yes. So while there is no rain in the stratosphere, it is true that in the winter over the pole, there are clouds forming. But these are not clouds that we see. They are so thin that even if they're there and we look up at the sky, we don't see them. And they're formed from ice particles. So the fact that they're thin that we can't see them means that sunlight can just go through them. It doesn't interact anything. It isn't reflected or anything. But what happens is that these ice particles of those polar stratospheric clouds, they do interact with long-wave radiation which comes back from the surface. And so they do block the radiation that comes back from the surface due to the temperature of the surface. It blocks that, and that's exactly the greenhouse effect. So that's exactly the same thing with carbon dioxide, with water vapor, but this time with these ice crystals from those polar stratospheric clouds. So they can, and that's been known for a while, they can have an effect, but so far we thought that that effect is so small that we don't have to care about it, because there's not many of those clouds, and they're only there in winter. And so what our research was trying to explore was, well, in particular in past climates, so very long time ago, we don't know how much methane there was in the atmosphere, but we think it was a lot more than was now. And so we ran a climate model which can deal with the chemistry and the clouds and radiation, and increased methane within the range that we think it could have been. And we found that if there's enough methane, we suddenly start producing a lot more of these polar stratospheric clouds, and therefore we have a larger greenhouse effect of these clouds, and that could contribute to polar amplification.
Okay, now I want to just jag over to another thing here, and I don't know whether you have an answer to this or not, but let's give it a shot. A listener sent me an article written by two Norwegian scientists, and among other concerns, they warn that solar storms causes the ionosphere to precipitate electrons, which then fall as electron precipitation, or EEP, and that increases nitrogen dioxide, damaging the ozone layer, they say. So we are reaching the peak of the sun's 11-year cycle. Martin, you have expertise on this. Do you think changes in solar activity are a factor in this year's ozone hole, or even in the extreme heat that's popping up around the world?
So, yeah, it is not my center of expertise, but I do not think that this... I think it's a question of order of magnitude. I'm certain that solar storms interact with the Earth's ionosphere. This is the whole reason why we see Arctic lights, or how they're called, auroras. That's the ionosphere interacting with solar wind, as we call it, so or storms from the sun. And those electrons, they can fly around, they can have effect on nitrogen. But what we see this year in terms of ozone hole has actually been predicted quite accurately simply by including the effect of the Hanga Tonga volcano, which we discussed before. And the reason there is that more water vapor in the stratosphere means also more ozone destruction. And that's due to how the ozone chemistry works. And so for this year's ozone hole, we have actually expected this to become very big this year because of that volcano. And that is enough of an explanation for why this ozone hole is so big. So, and then the ozone hole has a really minor effect on global temperatures, in particular in the northern hemisphere where we had the heat wave. The ozone hole is over the South Pole. The heat waves were in the northern hemisphere summer, far on the other side of the globe, basically. So I don't think we should link that solar activity to current warm global temperatures and the heat waves the northern hemisphere has experienced.
Okay, well, we've tried to cover a lot here. Martin, what are you working on next?
Next, I am working on trying to find out how storms, not thunderstorms, but large storms which bring flooding, how they might change, if at all, in the future, in order to try and be prepared for possibly more extensive flooding, in particular in Australia.
That's a big question. And here we're seeing all these floods in Turkey and Greece and Bulgaria and in South America. We saw them in China earlier this year, Japan. So it's definitely becoming a global phenomenon. We'll look forward to that research from the Climate Change Research Center at the University of New South Wales. We've been speaking with Dr. Martin Eucher. You can find links to the science we just talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Martin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
This year of 2023 has been a revelation for all of us, scientists included. Just as we thought to comprehend how the world works, surprises jolt our understanding. Why did Earth rapidly lose its solar shield in the Antarctic sea ice? Why did we take such a sharp jump in temperatures, not just in the Northern Hemisphere in the summer, but in the Southern winter as well? Why the big storms that are flooding city streets across the globe? Why is it starting to rain in Antarctica? Why is the great conveyor belt of ocean currents weakening? These things have experts guessing, testing new theories they are applying for grant money to find out. The rest of us are just reeling from repeated blows of record extreme weather. Some scientists, like Michael Mann at Penn State, suggests we do know why. The cause is global warming, built up from decades of fossil-powered emissions and deforestation. Others calculated all that and never came up with the extreme changes in events seen this year. They try to add a little for solar activity, a bit for ship pollution cuts, maybe extra methane from bogs and beaver ponds. Even all that doesn't give you record-smashing heat waves around the world, instant Cat 5 hurricanes, and destabilized glaciers in such a short period of time. All the best models and minds did not predict this, and now things are shifting so rapidly, maybe we can't predict what comes next. The prediction system is broken, and that could be as dangerous as the threat of nuclear war. We failed to plan for the known. Now we can hardly plan for the unknown, except maybe to duck down into a minimum footprint with a fallback position and manual backups for everything. What is pushing us into a dangerous new state so fast? We do not know, and we may not find out in time. As Naomi Klein would say, this changes everything. But there is still the joy of trying to discover all the amazing things on this planet and in this universe. For example, we heard Martin Eucher was trained in plasma physics. It blows my mind trying to understand plasma. I had to look it up again. We learn there's a fourth state of matter beyond solid, liquid, and gas. Plasma is 99.9% of visible matter in this universe, and the public knows practically nothing about it. Of course, we seldom experience it. The precession of matter is the story of heat, with heat being the energy or motion within the molecules and atoms. The lowest form of energy, almost frozen in space and time, are the solids from rocks to tree bark. Most solids, if you heat them enough, go into a liquid state. We see that when ice melts, but rocks too become liquid with the heat of volcanoes. Add a lot more heat to those liquids, and they dissipate into a gas form. Even metals can have a gas state. Their molecules and atoms float in the atmosphere. That is about as far up the ladder of heat humans can ever experience. But with enormous amounts of heat or energy, like the atomic fusion on our sun, atoms break up. Electrons can break free of the nucleus to form a kind of fog of particles. That is plasma. But these hard planets are lonely exceptions in a universe mostly containing fields of plasma mixed with cold space. There is hardly anything solid out there. Our situation on a rock in this solar system racing through space is extremely rare and perhaps unique. That is another reason why we should honor it and learn to live in harmony with all other life on our planetary home. With Wonder for the Universe, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.